Hi, I'm Bill Arnold. According to what I've just been told, here's the podcast for the Early Morning Late Show. Enjoy our conversations. Hear that song too many more times. And I certainly hope I've made a difference in your morning. Thanks so much for listening to Faith Radio. And I've got a kind of conflicted day today because this is my last morning doing the morning show, and then I'm moving to the afternoon starting Monday. So I will get to smash my alarm clock, which I'm okay with. But I will definitely miss you in the morning, and thank you so much for listening and supporting me and Faith Radio. It was on this day in 1944, the government of Mexico abolished the siesta. Just so you know, the government of Bill Arnold has not. All right, 14-year-old Karthik Numani won the $40,000 prize by being able to spell his own last name. He won the Scripps National Spelling Bee Contest. But actually, no, the word he spelled correctly was koinonia. And koinonia is defined as the Christian fellowship or body of believers. Did you know, and this is a little fun fact, in 1942, Clarence Jordan, he co-founded the Koinonia Farm in Americus, Georgia. And he wanted to sort of live out his New Testament principles to combat racism. And Koinonia Farm later ended up becoming Habitat for Humanity and other organizations that are still around today. Long after Clarence had died. But during the civil rights movement of the 50s and 60s, there were reported attacks from the Ku Klux Klan. There were bullets and death threats and destruction of property. And in 1954, the KKK burned every building on Jordan's property but his house. And during the raid that was organized, Jordan recognized the voice of a local newspaper reporter who was participating in the Klan. But he recognized his voice the night the Klan struck and burned down his property, with the exception of his house, his barns, and other things. But during the raid, he recognized the voice, and the next day the reporter showed up at the farm to cover the story. Talk about some chutzpah. So he shows up the next day acting like nothing had happened, and he's got his pen and paper in hand wanting to know what happened, and he had heard about the tragedy and wondered when the farm would close. And Jordan was out working in the field, African-American guy. He had a university degree in agriculture, and he had his doctorate in New Testament Greek. So he didn't really answer the reporter. The reporter kept asking him, when are you going to shut down? Because you obviously can't make this thing happen anymore. You cannot succeed. Now that everything is burned. And finally, I think Clarence Jordan said, you don't get it, do you? You do not understand us Christians. What we are is not about success, but faithfulness. I love that story. All right, we have a great show today. Carmen LaBurge is already on our studio line. We'll chat with her in just a minute. And we're going to also talk to Dr. Bruce Ashford, which I'm looking forward to. And then Adam Holtz is going to give us a little heads up as to what movies to watch or avoid over the weekend. And then Dr. Ann Bradley is going to be with me. That's going to be the day, and it's going to be a good one. It's 7 minutes after the hour. We'll take a short break and bring on Carmen. Good morning. It's 9 minutes after the hour. John Wilbur Chapman was writing a personal letter reflecting on rules to govern a spiritual life. And he said, anything that dims my vision of Christ or takes away my taste for Bible study or cramps me in my prayer life or makes Christian work difficult is wrong for me. And I must, as a Christian, turn away from it. Always good to be focused. And I pray that when you get up in the morning that you see the face of God before you even see your own. That's my goal any day. Every day and any day. But I have on our studio line Carmen LaBurge, host of Connecting Faith, reconnectwithcarmen.com. Hello, Carmen.
Good morning, Bill.
How are you?
Well, I suppose I'm conflicted. Indeed, today is the day that the Lord has made, and it is glorious and a privilege to be alive. But we live in complicated days, and sometimes being a Christian in these days is, it's a moment by moment challenge, not just internally, which is what you just described, but externally in terms of our public witness. So I think my honest answer to your question is today I'm a little conflicted.
Okay. I want to find out more about that. I always say in my head and in my heart that God, has a master plan, and I have to make
Amen.
Sure I have to make sure I recognize who the master is, and that would be him.
Amen. Amen.
Because sometimes
that's
we
exactly
think
right.
We think God's got a master plan, but you know what? I've got to be in charge today. And I go, nah, that's not the way it works.
Hey, before we march into the headline news, what are you going to be doing during the afternoon program? Like, are people going to be like getting the bill? The bill they know and that's good, because sometimes the person conforms to the format of a show versus the show adapting to the person. So I like the idea that you're gonna just move forward to a different time.
Yeah.
That even sounds kind of like crazy. But anyway.
Yeah, I know they'll probably tune in and go, "Huh, I've never heard Bill fully awake. He's quite dull."
Yeah, listen to that. I think it's gonna be thrilling.
I didn't know he was that boring.
So you're good in the middle of the night. Didn't you do the late show before you did the early show?
Oh,
and now you're
yes,
moving to the afternoon.
Ever. Yes, I mean, I was so used to working at night.
Yeah. Huh.
And then
I don't know. Is this progress? Old people eat at like 5 in the afternoon. So maybe this is just progress toward, I don't know.
I don't either. Carmen, I've always considered the morning time as such sacred time. It's sacred time in a person's day. Because it's usually when they have their quiet time. It's usually when they've just come out of a sleep. They might be a little groggy. They're hungry to get some news, weather, and traffic and updates. And they want to connect to the world.
Right.
And they turn the radio on and they hear my voice. So I've always considered that to be so sacred and such an honor
Absolutely.
To be part of. And, sometimes we get up in the morning and people say, "Well, I've got my alarm clock set. So when my alarm goes off, I hear you talking." And I go, "Well, that's kind of weird, but but I'll take it because I want to be talking to you. I want to be encouraging you. I want to be lifting you up. I want to be making you laugh. I want to be giving you courage and some spiritual wisdom and insight for the day that hopefully comes from the Holy Spirit, not even from me, but from the Holy Spirit, because I want you to feel really empowered to go out and do what God calls you to do this day. So to be stepping away from that makes me a little crazy. But I love the idea that the afternoon drive is every bit as important. It just feels maybe a little bit more relaxed, but there's going to be a lot of people in traffic, and they're going to be driving, and they're going to have had a busy day, and they're going to want a little bit more of that as well, I think. I hope.
Oh, I think it's a perfect time for like a reset, like a genuine reset of the soul. Like, hey, remember when we got up this morning and had a quiet time? Well, 2 in the afternoon, still sacred, still belongs to God, still a good opportunity to turn to Him and turn our thoughts to Him and submit to Him. And I'm excited for you. It's great.
Well, I appreciate that. When I started this job, I started not knowing really what it would be like, because I've been a late night person for so long. I've been performing and being up till whenever I wanted to be and getting up whenever I wanted to be. And so it was a big change, but I've loved it. And I'm very awake during work, but then I feel a little bit like a zombie the rest of the day, which is kind of the only downside to morning radio, because I take the job real seriously. And, I've got my alarm set for 3:30, but oftentimes I wake up at 2:30 and I don't get back to sleep. And that's not getting up
no,
early.
Right.
That's getting
no,
up in the middle
and-
of the night.
Yeah, so you're going to, part of this, we just need to pray for you over the weekend that you actually sort of get your, get all of your rhythms reset so that you're not napping at 2 in the afternoon.
But yeah, some of the response I've had from listeners, it's been just so incredibly wonderful, and people have been so nice. And so I want to be just gushing with to the listeners today, saying thank you for letting me, you know, letting me come into your through your radio.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, and let's affirm that people who are listening to the early morning late show on Monday, you know, there'll be somebody there.
Yes. Matter of fact, General Manager Dick Whitworth will be here on Monday. And
oh, fun.
Yep. And Neil Stavem, the golden voice of Neil, will be here regularly as well. And I think
that's fun.
I think Dr.
Good.
Peter Kapsner is going to drop in once in a while and give it a go. And so there's lots of great talent in the morning that will show up, and they're going to start a search for a new morning host. And I just pray they're nowhere near as good as me.
Oh, well, there you go. Everybody who is listening on Faith Radio, there is a plan. It is in the hands of the master, and the rest of us are just trying to figure it out.
Yeah, yeah. And, of course, I was talking about that 14-year-old kid who won the Scripps Spelling Bee. And
yeah, I love that. I love that. I can't believe that the winning word was koinonia.
Koinonia.
I can't believe that the definition of the winning word begins with the word Christian. I mean, I just feel like what a great opportunity today, right?
Yeah, exactly. And I just thought that's a fun little news item, and it's you can bring that up in conversation anywhere. Did you hear about the kid who won the Scripps National Spelling Bee? 14-year-old. He spelled the word koinonia. Do you know how to spell that? And they'll probably say no.
Well, and it starts with a K.
Starts with a K.
Well, I know. And so let's just begin with it starts with a K. So people who want to look it up so that they can learn how to spell it, it starts with a K. And I think that for Christians, Bill, you know, the one thing that I would say is it's one thing to know how to spell it. It's another thing to live it.
Right. But Carmen, isn't it a great word that we can use in our conversation today to start a conversation with somebody?
Such a great word. Yeah, absolutely. It would be the positive headline news of the day in terms of getting God back into the conversation. Absolutely.
Yeah. Yeah. All right, Carmen, let me take a little break. And then when we come back, we'll talk about some of the news of the day. Carmen LeBurge is my guest. We'll be right back. Minutes after the hour, Carmen LeBurge is my guest this morning, host of Connecting Faith, reconnectwithcarmen.com. Carmen, it seems that in 1991, there was a gentleman named James Davison Hunter who coined the phrase culture wars. Sounds like he's having some regret about that now.
So culture wars and the idea of a culture war is certainly something people are extremely familiar with. We probably imagine that's been the way Christians have always talked about their relationship with the trends, the secularizing trends happening around them. But in fact, it's really only been a part of our sort of common parlance for, I don't know, a couple of decades. And so Pat Buchanan is actually the one who took this this culture wars language and applied it to the political sphere. And I think that in that particular transition, we kind of weaponized our Christian influence in terms of how we engage politically. And so what this conversation is about is looking – this is an article in the Wall Street Journal for people who are wondering why we're talking about this today, this conversation about – the use of the language culture wars, who's winning the culture wars, where the mountains of cultural influence really are, who's standing on top of those, what's downstream from those. It's an excellent, easy to understand, I think, quick exposition of where we are in terms of the waning cultural influence of those of us who believe in a higher authority and seek to live our lives in alignment with that higher authority, in our case, God, in our case, Jesus Christ, the God revealed fully and finally in the person of Jesus Christ, the Lord of our conscience, the Lord of our lives, but also for, you know, for Jews and other people who believe in God, we actually all find ourselves on the same side of these quote-unquote culture wars over and against what he describes as progressives or secularists. And I think that we imagine, Bill, that those are the lines that have always existed. But actually, prior to sort of this era in America, the dividing lines have actually been between religious groups, not inside, internally, inside Catholicism or inside Protestantism or inside Judaism, where you could actually have Orthodox or traditional people in all of those groups who hold the same position on, let's say, life or abortion, and progressives or secularists within each one of those religious groups who would line up over and against the traditionalists or the Orthodox. This is actually the first time in history that's ever happened.
Wow.
And so that's where the culture war conversation really gets started. I think it's helpful for people to understand the language.
Yeah, it definitely is. That's good insight too, Carmen. So speaking of how life gets weird and twisted, there is employees now that are quitting the American Bible Society because the American Bible Society apparently has required all employees to adhere to Orthodox Christian beliefs. It's like, huh. Explain that one to me.
Yeah, so
and they're quitting over that.
So this is where the belief line and the behavior line and the question of whether or not your sincerely held religious beliefs are actually reflected not only in your behavior, let's say in an hour of worship, but in every aspect of your life, including your vocational life. And so I think when we want to have a conversation with our neighbors about the freedom of religion, we want to have a conversation, you know, not just about being sure that people can go to the church of their choice without fear, on a particular day of the week at a particular hour. We actually want people to be able to freely exercise their religion, not just believe what they believe, but exercise their religion in every aspect of their life, which means I don't privatize my faith. In fact, I make it very public. It influences everything, including what I do at work. Well, this conversation then moves us into, does an employer, in this case a religious employer, have the right to say then to employees, hey, we're a religious organization. Actually, we are the Bible Society, and we want people to adhere to what the Bible says in this particular area of life, not only being a member of a church, but participating in the life of a local congregation and having keeping your sexuality confined to the way the Bible defines marriage between one man and one woman in a monogamous relationship. People have rebuffed that. Why? Well, maybe because they don't believe it, certainly because they don't want to conform their behavior to it. And so it's going to be, I believe, a very public, ongoing conversation as employees do quit, and my guess is then turn around and sue.
Okay. So are we just, as I'm looking at what's happened with Roseanne Barr and others, are we all one bad tweet away from being fired and having everything get erased in our lives? Or has that always been the case? Because whether it's what we tweet or what we say, we're one step away from disaster.
You know, I think that as Christians, we might be more thoughtful about our social media than a person who doesn't claim to be a Christian, because we at least recognize that's a part of our public witness. I'm not saying that every Christian on Twitter or every Christian on Facebook, says a prayer and actually, asks God, do you actually want this out there representing you? I mean, I recognize I'm a Christian. Does this accurately represent who you are, your character, your position, and the way you would communicate yourself to the world? I don't think we do that every time. Maybe we should. But certainly what the Roseanne Barr Samantha Bee, I think, what they bear out, is just a growing like crudeness and vulgarity. But the other thing, though, I think that it bears out is that even a progressive secular culture has a limit. And so I think that the question that I've been asking people since the Roseanne Barr tweet storm was this: why, if you actually believe that human beings evolved from animals, and in some cases you're okay elevating animals to the position of people, giving them, like, let's say, rights in court, and you want to be sure that I use the name of, let's say, Harambe the gorilla. I know that goes back a couple of years, but we tend to try to humanize animals, and we recognize in some cases the animalistic behavior of human beings, and that gets us sort of into the MS-13 conversation and the use of the or the application of the word animal to people. I don't think you can do either. Animals are not people, and people are not animals. And so when we talk about redeeming the conversation, we have to think right, and then we have to speak right.
Mm-hmm. Yesterday I was talking about this very thing, about the animals conversation, Carmen, and a listener had said, well, what about the when Jesus said, you are of your father, the devil? So devil is
I think you're right.
A
now
reptile,
there's
an animal.
There's no question.
Yeah.
Yeah, there's no question people can behave like animals. That's no question. And I think that's accurate language. When our behavior is animalistic, we should say so, right?
Mm-hmm.
But
I
that's
agree.
About moral accountability. And anytime we reduce a person to the status of an animal, we have suggested that person's not morally accountable. And I think that person is morally accountable. And what we're talking about is sin, and we need to name it as such.
Mm-hmm. Carmen, thank you so much for coming on the show. Who do you have on today on Connecting Faith?
Yeah, so we're talking about religious liberty today with Travis Wusso, and we're going to talk about all of the things that face us internationally as Christians seeking to advance the religious liberty of our neighbors around the world.
Sounds awesome, and I hope you have a great conversation with him and have a great weekend, and I will see you when I see you.
Thank you, my brother.
You bet. Thanks, Carmen. Carmen LeBurge has been my guest, host of Connecting Faith. It is 28 minutes after the hour. We'll take a little break and be back in a minute. It's 30 minutes after the hour. Good morning. It's June 1st. So glad you're listening to the show this morning. Early Morning Late Show has been such a gift, and I love it, and I thank you for loving it, and I love you. But we're going to take right now a little break for news, and then when we come back, we're going to have a chance to have a conversation with Dr. Bruce Ashford. I'm looking forward to that. Be back in just a minute.
God loves you is one thing, but bring up God's judgment, whoa, and the party's over. This is Jim Garlow, and I'm talking here about Christian friends and family. There's no doubt about God's love, 1 John 4:16. It says it's so. A large part of my master's thesis was on the word agape, which means, of course, God's love. And a word from the Old Testament, the word chesed, which means God's love. Admittedly, the Bible is filled with God's love. But the Bible also speaks much about judgment. God is a God of justice. Oh, I know, it's not as cool to talk about that, because we've switched it around. Instead of God making us in His image, we've remade God in our image. Love is so much easier to speak of, isn't it? But you can't avoid it. God's love and His judgment are in the book, like it or not. We'll do our part, keeping you informed at jimgarlow.com.
Hi, I'm Ted Ross with a Faith in Life Minute. Being a parent can be scary and worrisome. Becky Harling is an author, speaker, and life coach, and she says it can be dangerous to worry too much.
The reason it's dangerous is because, number one, Satan attacks parents there. You know, from the moment you give birth to that child, Satan starts with what I call his blah, blah, blah in your ear, you know. You're inadequate, you can't parent, you don't know what you're doing, you know. And it's dangerous to listen to Satan's voice because God has no doubts about you as a parent. He believes in you, and He has called you to this challenge. And when we allow fear and anxiety to rule our thinking, we really pass that down to our children. And that cycle needs to break, because we want children who are confident and confident in what the Lord can do in their lives.
Go to myfaithradio.com to hear more from Becky Harling.
Twenty-four minutes until the top of the hour. It is June number one. Love June 1. You know, I've been seeing a lot of people wearing camouflage these days, so it must not be very good camouflage. Anyway, Bruce Ashford is my guest this morning. He's written a book that's being released June 1. It's called Letters to an American Christian, and he's here to discuss that book with me. Good morning, Bruce.
Good morning, Bill. Thank you for having me back on the show.
I love you. I love you coming onto the show, and your insight is always so spot on. And I want to talk about your book being officially released today. And so let's talk about a chapter out of the book or two, if you don't mind. In chapter 9, you said there are no safe spaces in the real world. I love that.
Yeah, thank you. So this book, as we talked about a week or two ago, it's a really fun book to write, fun one to read. And I wrote it for college students, young professionals, people who are struggling with how to be a faithful Christian and a faithful conservative in an era where the ground has shifted beneath us. And one of the ways the ground has shifted beneath us, I think, is there's this fight going on in our country between free speech, which is enshrined in our Constitution, on the one hand, and the politically correct regime, on the other hand.
Mm-hmm.
Political correctness, as I see it, is a social code that whatever is the most recent sort of national trend and opinion, a politically correct social code forms around it, and you're not supposed to violate it. And so it makes it difficult to put your cards on the table until you really are. And what we've seen is on public university campuses and in public spaces, public squares, we've seen people shouted down, pepper sprayed, punched in the mouth, and so forth because of the ideas that they've got. Now, sometimes those ideas are absolutely reprehensible. They're overtly and grossly racist. But then sometimes they're not. You've had people shouted down and pepper sprayed for saying that they were members of the NRA. And so in the chapter, what I do is I counsel a hypothetical college student how to deal with his secular progressive professor who is okay with the shuttering of free speech. Mm. And I give him several different ways to show his fellow college students and his professor why that's a bad idea. Okay. You want me to walk through them?
I would love to. Yeah, please.
Yeah. Yeah. So, I think it defeats to shut down free speech defeats the purpose of going to a public university in the first place. I mean, why are you going? You're going for the exchange of ideas.
Right.
Right. And so it kind of defeats the whole purpose. It's a little bit totalitarian because the PC regime, what it basically says is whatever ideas are popular today that the majority of professors or the majority of the elite or maybe the majority of the American population, whatever ideas it is that we've got enshrined today, you can't violate those or we will shut you down.
Mm-hmm.
A second problem with shuttering free speech in public spaces is it erodes the free and democratic nature of American society. I mean, our nation is built on this truth that every citizen should be able to express his or her opinion in public spaces. Doesn't mean you can express them in private spaces. You know, there can be norms inside of homes and churches and certain private institutions, but in public, if you're a member of the country, if you're a citizen, you can speak your mind. And it undermines that when we tell people that they can't or when we intimidate them for doing it.
Mm-hmm.
Third one is big, Bill, and that's this, that if the PC regime, what it does is it intimidates and bullies and tells people they ought to keep their ideas to themselves. And what that does is it encourages hypocrisy, right?
Mm-hmm.
It encourages people to hide who they really are. And I want to know who they are. If somebody's got ugly views, I'd like them to put it on the table.
Mm-hmm.
I'd like to know it. I don't want to be sitting next to somebody and not be aware of who they are. And even while it encourages hypocrisy, when you shut down free speech, it undermines our ability to persuade people, right? If we don't know who they are, how can we win them over? So I want to let people say, what they think so we can win them over.
Mm. You're making sense again, Bruce. Why do you do
that
this?
I can,
Yeah, why do you do this to me?
Because you pay me $10 every time my interview is a good one, and then I get no money whenever you say it's a bad one. a couple more reasons. The PC regime and the shuttering of free speech ignores the fact that social progress often depends upon free speech, right?
Mm-hmm.
So some of the same people who want to shut free speech down now, I bet they didn't want to shut it down in the 1950s and 60s or in the Civil Rights Movement. Right. When free speech against racism is something that allowed our society to progress. And then finally, and this is a big one, is that similar to, I think, socialist forms of economics, that the shuttering of free speech tilt society in an authoritarian direction. And that's something our founders, our founding fathers, worked very hard to set up our country so that that wouldn't happen. And we don't want to undermine their good efforts, their good faith efforts in that manner.
Mm-hmm.
Does that make sense, Bill?
It makes a lot of sense. And the whole idea that people want to shut you down is something that I think is so true, because they might just come out with hate speech if you say something versus, oh, boy, you really don't want to have any kind of dialogue whatsoever. You just want to shut me down.
And I, you know, I think one reason that we like to shut other people's speech down is we don't know how to persuade them, right?
Yeah.
On the left, there are people who want to shut it down. On the right, sometimes there are too. And this book teaches people how to persuade.
Mm-hmm.
Every chapter is a brief letter trying to equip you to have a brief, kind of snappy, maybe even witty, way of entering into a conversation and winning the other person over. So I think it's a great gift to give to a graduating high school student, graduating college student, to a to a friend who wants to know, how can I stand there in the moment in public as a Christian and not be a jerk, but also and not to feel sort of flat-footed in the conversation? How can I have something to say and be persuasive?
Yeah.
I think we need to do that.
Bruce, one of the things I love about your book and the format of your book is you can pretty much open it up anywhere and learn something and have something to walk away with in a little brown paper bag.
Oh, yeah. You don't have to read it in order.
I mean,
I recommend that you read it in order, but you can just pick a hot-button topic, and we treat everything. Immigration, the economy, transgenderism,
yeah.
Free speech.
Let's talk about hot button issues, because obviously, what is the Christian view? How should we be looking at hot button issues?
Yeah. So the interesting thing, in the life of our country, every decade there'll be new issues that rise to the surface. They're not new, but we tend to emphasize certain issues over others differently each decade or each sort of season of our country. And then as Christians, we kind of scramble to figure out, what is a Christian view on this? And the reason it's tough is because the Bible is not a manual for political views in a 21st century democratic republic. Like, it doesn't have a list for us. And here is what you will say if you get into a debate on transgender ideology. So what we have to do is we have to do the hard work of taking biblical principles and then reasoning toward a faithful application of those to hot button issues. And we don't have time to do that on 100 different issues. And so what I've hoped is that I have had time to do that on about 25 or 30 issues, and in this book I'm giving you the fruits of my research, and
mm-hmm.
hopefully it'll be somewhat helpful.
Yeah. Bruce, one of your chapters you say that nobody throws a tantrum like a politically correct American. That makes me laugh.
Yeah. Well, there's been so many temper tantrums, haven't there, the past couple of years?
Oh, it's what we deal with every day. It's a big, gigantic tantrum. Yeah.
Yeah, even our talk show hosts, not you, of course, but other talk show hosts, really the political talk show hosts often on radio and TV throw tantrums. And they throw tantrums live. And if the guest that they've got on disagrees with them, then they butt in and interrupt and mock them. And we just can't – finding a reasonable American is probably more difficult than finding the plot of a Steven Seagal movie. there's one there.
It's in there somewhere.
Wait,
somebody just got punched. That might have something to do with the plot, but I'm not sure.
Maybe that is the plot. So the tolerance movement in America, similar to the politically correct movement, is very intolerant. And the reason is, if you think for a minute, is for them truth is subjective, and it's not equated with truths given by God in the Bible, for example. It's equated with personal identity. And so whatever is true for me is my experience of the way I am as a person. So when that's the case, when truth is determined by your identity, then disagreement is not disagreement. Disagreement is hatred,
mm-hmm.
bigotry, and phobia, right? So, politically incorrect, that phrase actually comes from an old Soviet joke from Soviet Union. I lived in the Soviet Union in the 90s. I heard this joke, and the joke goes something like this, that one Soviet guy says to another, "Comrade, your statement is factually incorrect." And the other one says, "Yes, it is, but it is politically correct." So there's a party line, and you better toe the party line, and if you don't, you're going to be treated as a bad person. So it started as a Soviet joke that was making fun of the PC regime of the Soviet Union, has become a humorless American reality.
Yeah.
And so what I argue is that instead of political correctness, we need civility. Now, civility gets a black eye. When I say to be civil, sometimes people think that means being weak-kneed, you know, and not strong. But civility is here's how civility differs from political correctness. Political correctness is hiding what you really believe because of social pressure from the outside. Civility is the opposite of that. It is speaking what you really believe in spite of social pressure on the outside, and yet you speak it with the proper respect for the other person, even if the person's ugly to you, if they're lying about you, even if they're mocking you and insulting you. You can be strong without being ungodly in your response.
Yeah.
The civility is strength under control.
That is awesome. All right, Bruce, let me take a little break. When I come back, I'm going to continue my conversation with Dr. Bruce Ashford. He's written a book called Letters to an American Christian. And in chapter 13, the title is Beware the Giant Octopus. And in chapter 18, the title is To Shave a Yak. I will ask him to comment on one of those two items. And that is called a tease, which in radio is a technique that hopes the listeners will stay. We'll take a short break and be right back. It is 10 minutes until the top of the hour. Speaking to Dr. Bruce Riley Ashford, he's written a book called Letters to an American Christian. Bruce, right before we went to break, I threw out the big cliffhanger. Chapter 13 says, Beware the Giant Octopus. And chapter 18 is To Shave a Yak. The floor is yours.
Yeah, I mean,
which one do you want to address?
I mean, how can you top that?
Exactly. Let's close
like
in prayer.
That. Let's start with the giant octopus.
Yeah, all right.
You know, so the quote comes from a great Christian theologian who was also the prime minister of the Netherlands.
Okay.
About 100 years ago. And he said that government tends to be like a giant octopus that swells and reaches its tentacles into every square inch of human existence. And that we need to resist that tendency that goes against God's design. That God has designed different types of culture, art, science, politics, family, church, etc., and that each type of culture has its own reason for being, but also limits to its jurisdiction. So the state has some very serious limits to its jurisdiction and needs to keep its tentacles out of everybody else's business.
Mm.
And so, you know, this chapter is really about economics. And so I begin with a biblical treatment of economics, that we need to be careful how we acquire wealth, to do it in a just and a moral way, be careful how we use it, not use it for the wrong reasons. And then finally, not to love it too much. In other words, not to love it more than we love the Lord.
Mm-hmm.
And it really go into a comparison of the socialist tendency and the capitalist tendency. And what I end up arguing is that socialism, you know, Karl Marx had good intentions with socialism, but he was wrong.
Mm-hmm.
He created a bad system. It's an ideology that competes with the Christian faith. And it's the greatest poverty-inducing economic system in the history of the world. It does bring you material equality, but it's the kind of equality that ships receive when there's a low tide, that they all sink together. I lived in the former Soviet Union and saw it. I've been in numerous socialist countries, and it just doesn't work. You can't get your smartest politicians together in a room and get them to centrally plan an economy and determine what costs what and who gets paid what.
Mm-hmm.
Economy needs to determine that. So I try to explain that and explain it hopefully in a simple way, that the best way for a market to run is for it to be relatively free, where buyers and sellers are exchanging for things that they need or want, and the demand for those products is what causes the price. So in a socialist country, if I want to go to the store and buy three racks of ribs and a bottle of John Boy and Billy's grilling sauce, I mean, I'm just saying.
I hear you. I hear you, Bruce.
Socialist country, they probably wouldn't even have that, but
yeah.
If they did, they might say, listen, you can't buy three racks of ribs, you can only buy one, it's rationed. And
what about the sauce? You can get all the sauce you want,
yeah.
Can't you?
Yeah.
Don't
yeah.
do this
well,
to me, Bruce.
You probably can't even get the sauce that you want. I'm sorry.
I hate the socialism you speak of.
Yeah, exactly. You know, so the government shouldn't get in the way, because the buyers have better and more information about their own concerns than the government can have. The government's not going to know who wants or who needs what.
Right.
And so when the government, the more it interferes in the market, the more it distorts the market, and the more things get out of whack, and it hurts the consumer, the very people that socialism, you know, is supposed to help. Does that make sense?
It does make a lot of sense. I mean, you are the gymnast coming off the high bar that sticks the landing.
Okay.
Because honestly, Bruce, that's what each one of these little chapters feels like. It feels like I've got, you're sticking the landing. I go, oh, now I get it. I think I've got some tools now to work with, and I've got a little bit of a background to understand and put things in context and engage in conversations that actually can not end up just being in fights. And during the break, Logan was talking about when he confronts like a social justice warrior in conversation, he wants to speak, but they're just yelling at him and they're screaming him down. And he goes, I don't know how to engage with them. Is it even possible? So,
yeah, that's right. I think none of us as Americans are equipped right off the bat to engage on any of the 50 to 100 hot button issues that might be addressed in the states. And so hopefully this book helps equip people to do that.
Yeah.
Now, the shaving the yak chapter, you have to be thinking, what in God's good earth, could this possibly talk about? So the phrase yak shaving, oddly enough, comes from a cartoon in the 1990s called Ren and Stimpy. I don't necessarily recommend the cartoon, but in that cartoon, and actually, by the way, this phrase was adopted by the MIT Artificial Intelligence Lab, a phrase from Ren and Stimpy was. Yak shaving is, according to that cartoon, it's what you're doing when you're doing some fiddly little task that bears no obvious relationship to what you're supposed to be working on, but because of a chain of causal links, that little thing that you're working on actually helps with the original task. So let me explain. So we're having a lot of debates about global warming, right?
Mm-hmm.
About the environment. I think we should talk about the environment. Any Christian in their right mind, if God created the world and if it's his good creation, we should care about his good creation. We shouldn't intentionally trash it. When Christ returns, he's going to renew and restore this heavens and earth. God's not going to trash it and do away with it. He's going to renew it and make it better. And so we ought to not trash it either. But, you know, global warming is a very complicated issue. We're not dead sure that this is global warming is something caused by humans or something that will continue. It could be something cyclical that happens every few thousand years. We don't know because we haven't recorded, global temperatures for a few thousand years. So we're just not sure. But one thing we can do, so global warming, you know, whether it's happening and whether it's caused by us is something a little bit out of our control. And that reduce, reuse, recycle, you know, that's something we could do. But honestly, we really, as individual Americans, can't control it. Mm-hmm. If it's true, humans are causing global warming, then what we have to do is land all the airplanes and park all the cars worldwide.
Right. Yeah.
Like China and India has 4 billion people. But what we can do and what we can control are other things. Take, for example, Katrina. Remember when Katrina happened?
Yeah. I just think we're getting over our skis here a little bit only because I'm running out of time. So,
okay.
I know I want to continue this conversation with you, but we are a little bit out of time. So I will... I'll call you again, and we'll continue talking about your book because it's
great.
Wonderful stuff. And I want to just thank you for being such a great guest on the Early Morning Late Show.
Great to be on the show, Bill. Thank you.
Yeah, have a great day. It's 2 minutes till the top of the hour. We'll take a short break and wrap up hour one.
Hi, I'm Marissa. I was drinking all day long. When I came to Teen Challenge, they introduced me to Jesus Christ. He loved me even at my worst moments. And he was the one who gently brought me into a new life.
Hi, this is Luis Palau. If you know an adult or teenager struggling with an addiction, call Teen Challenge today at 417-581-2181 or reach them on the web at teenchallengeusa.com.
Tune in this weekend to hear about how we can address growing problems in our world and our lives on the Dr. Linda Mental Show. Hi, I'm Dr. Linda Mental, the relationship doctor. As a marriage and family therapist, I've gained insights and experience with numerous relationship issues that we face. And I want you to find healing and hope for the things you face in your life. Life is better together, and you don't have to do it alone. Tune in Saturday mornings at 10:30 and Sunday evenings at 6:30 on Faith Radio.
Thanks for listening to the Early Morning Late Show podcast. These conversations are available because of your prayerful and financial support. Make a gift now at myfaithradio.com. To avoid missing future editions of the Early Morning Late Show, subscribe to the podcast today at iTunes or your podcast player. And thanks for sharing this audio link with a friend and grow the impact of the Early Morning Late Show.